नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय परमानुमये चित्तं भूतानां मयिरञ्जयन् कालसूक्ष्मार्थतां योगी लघिमानं अवाप्नुयात्। I exist within everything, and I am therefore the essence of the atomic constituents of material elements. By attaching his mind to me in this form, the yogi may achieve the perfection called Laghima, by which he realizes the subtle atomic substance of time. We are reading today from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 15, entitled Description of Mystic Yoga Perfections, Text 12. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna set the stage in such a way to facilitate the purpose of the speaking of Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna, who was an enlightened yogi, who was a pure devotee and dear friend of Krishna, was put in such a situation that he was bewildered. The complexities of material natures have this power. We can make our plans. We could be pious, impious. We could have great wealth, physical health and strength, or none at all. Whatever particular arrangement we may make, material nature is designed in such a way to baffle us, to undermine our expectations. It's the way it's always been. It's the way it will always be. And yet each and every one of us tries to be the exception. Abrama bhavana loka punaravartuno arjuna mamubhedyate kaunteya punar janma navidyate. But just to enlighten us from that illusion, Krishna tells there are no exceptions. From the highest planet of Brahma loka, including Brahma, down to Patala Loka, as Brahma Samhita tells, from Indra to the Indra Gopa, from the king of the heavens to the atomic particle. Everything is under the influence of this illusory energy within the context of creation. So Arjuna was not only such a great, intimate, famous devotee of Krishna, But he had his Gandiva bow. He was unconquerable in battle. Everything material was in his favor. But yet, such a complication was put before him. And in that state, he became covered over. And in that condition, he turned to Krishna. It wasn't like going to a university class on philosophy. He was seeking shelter. And this is the very basis of realization. Jnana and vijnana. Knowledge can be theoretical. We can memorize. If we have a good brain due to some past karmas and due to practicing and developing it within this life, we could recall, we could repeat eloquently. But vijnana, realization, only comes when we follow in the footsteps of Arjuna and we take shelter. We're humbled by the powers that are beyond us. Until we recognize that, we cannot take shelter. Arjuna felt himself helpless, physically, intellectually, mentally, emotionally. He felt helpless. Although he was such a scholar, warrior, manager, and he turned to Krishna. Karpanya doso bahata svabhava. I don't know, please instruct me. Arjuna didn't inquire just for the sake of knowing. He inquired because his life depended upon it. And ultimately what Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita in approximate 700 verses is he's telling Arjuna, I'm reminding you what you have forgotten. But you cannot remember these things until you forego the ideas of janasyo moho yamaham mameti. These misconceptions of I and mine. I am these particular designations of this body. And whatever knowledge, whatever skills, whatever wealth, whatever relationships are mine. And we must understand that I'm part of Krishna, I'm part of God. Nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitananam eko bahunam yobadadati kama. The Upanishad tells that there's one supreme eternal who is the controller of all controllers. And there are limitless eternals. The jivas, who are forever subordinate and dependent on the one supreme eternal. And we are liberated, we are free from all the sufferings, complications, implications, and limitations of material existence. when we recognize this truth, that I'm dependent upon Krishna, and we take shelter of Krishna. It's just the opposite of the popular material theory that greatness is about being independent, being self-made. I've done it myself. Prakrite kriyamanani guni karmani sarvasha. Krishna says, the bewildered spirit soul thinks themselves to be the doer of their activities. But yet we work so hard and give our whole life just so that we could feel our, I am the doer, and so others could recognize that I'm the doer. And we think we'll be happy. But the basic principle of the whole material existence is the ego, ahankar, and the tendency, the deep-rooted, inseparable tendency of the false ego is envy. So when we want to try to accomplish something to impress people, we get some impression, but deep down inside we get a lot of envy too. And envy means people are, envy is the opposite of being a well-wisher. It means for my own sake, our hope is it's at the expense of you. When Srila Prabhupada wrote on every letter he sent, your ever well wisher, it means he's not envious of anyone. That's a pure devotee. And Krishna tells us to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, the only person who can understand this message is one who doesn't have envy. Which means one who's truly a well-wisher of everyone, according to time, place, and circumstance. We express that well-wishing nature. Just yesterday I was listening to a recording of Srila Prabhupada. It was in Vrindavan. And the title of the lecture is How to Live Without Envy. It's not that you just listen to the tape and you're free of envy. It's applying what the tape tells us. And that begins by understanding the values of what we're going to pursue and what we're going to ignore. Because the nature of the mind is always proposing so many different experiences. And we must ignore those things that are unfavorable for devotional service, and we must pursue that which is favorable. So Srila Prabhupada is describing from Krishna's perspective. And he's citing Krishna that if we want to please Krishna, we must be willing to try to please Krishna's devotees. Mad bhakta pujapyadika. And Srila Prabhupada said, if you're envious of Krishna, Krishna doesn't mind so much. But if you're envious of Krishna's devotee, Krishna does not tolerate it. So Prabhupada is explaining here very clearly that envy of a devotee is more unfavorable, or in other words, less favorable, than being envious of Krishna. Because just the fact that we're in this world and we want to be controller, proprietor, enjoyer, means there's a certain envy. But we can be free from that envy by learning how to be non-envious to Krishna's devotees. But that's difficult, because there's such a deep-rooted conditioning. And it's not only supported, verified, and amplified by the surroundings of the atmosphere of this world. It's very difficult. But we must recognize it and live to overcome it. Not to feed the enemy, but to starve the enemy. But you can't starve the enemy unless you're feeding what's favorable. How to actually be a well-wisher and a servant of a servant. It's only possible when we recognize how much we are affected by this material energy and we take shelter of Krishna. And those who are transcendental to material nature completely, they take shelter of Krishna the most at every moment, out of love. So we can take shelter of Krishna out of love in the pure state, or out of necessity in the neophyte condition. And here in this particular section of Srimad Bhagavatam, Uddhava, he's Krishna's best friend. But in certain ways, even closer than Arjuna. Because Arjuna lived in Hastinapur, and Krishna lived in Dwarka, and they would visit each other. But Uddhava lived in Dwarka. And when Krishna would go to visit other places, Uddhava would even go with him to those places. He was practically a constant associate, watching Krishna, seeing Krishna, talking to Krishna, eating with Krishna, playing with Krishna. And when Krishna wanted to send the most intimate message he ever sent in all of his leelas in this world, when he sent a message to the gopis and gopas of Vrindavan, he sent Uddhava. How much Krishna trusted Uddhava to carry that message. If you have an intimate message that's going to be a matter of life and death to the people that you love the most, you need someone you really trust to carry that message. Krishna sent Uddhava. And in sending Uddhava, Krishna revealed to Uddhava how insignificant he was. See how Krishna is limitlessly filled with loving rasas for his devotees. He wanted Uddhava to learn from the gopis and gopas, from the Brijavasis, rather than just tell him himself. When Krishna wanted Uddhava to understand what his shortcomings were in the science of the ecstasies of pure devotion, Krishna didn't just explain it to him. Seeing is believing. He taught him by giving him the association of devotees. And even the gopis, they didn't instruct Uddhava. They didn't give him a science of self-discovery class. They were just who they were. That's all. Of course, we should all go to the science of self-discovery. Because then we get to associate with Radha Gopinath Prabhu and so many other teachers. And in that association, we get transformed. Just by hearing from them, it's a way of associating with the compassion of their hearts that transforms us. So when the gopis and gopas, they were telling Uddhava, "You are so fortunate, you're with Krishna, but we are supremely unfortunate because Krishna left us." That was their mood. They were not in the mood of being the teachers or the gurus. They were just honestly expressing their hearts in the utmost possible humility. And when Uddhava saw that, he recognized, "I actually have no love for Krishna. Now I see what love for Krishna is." And what was Uddhava's purpose at that point? It wasn't to imitate the gopis. It was to serve the gopis. "Let me become a piece of grass on the ground of Vrindavan, so when the cows who are dear to the gopis, or any of the animals, even the frogs, because everyone's dear to everyone in Vrindavan, when they step on my head, and gopis and gopas, then I will be there to give some little happiness to their lotus feet." That was his ultimate aspiration. Why? Because he knew that nothing would please Krishna more than if he did that. If I can give pleasure to those who love Krishna, Krishna will be happiest with me, more than anything I could do for Krishna directly. That is the conclusion of Uddhava. And through Uddhava, Krishna's teaching us that conclusion. And here it is, after living with Krishna for well over 100 years as his constant associate, Krishna is about to leave the world and take the whole Yadu dynasty with him and leave Uddhava all alone in this world. That's unimaginable. Krishna's leaving with all his associates. And at this time, he already liberated Dantavakra. And after that, Krishna took all the Brijabasis back to Goloka Vrindavan. So here we are, all the Brijabasis are gone. Krishna took them back to the spiritual world. Krishna's about to take the whole Yadu dynasty, which means the entire family of great devotees, and Krishna's going to leave, and Balaram's going to leave. But Uddhava, you stay. Hare Krishna. So Uddhava is in a state of really taking shelter when he's inquiring from Krishna here. And interestingly, Uddhava, the only subject he's asking about is pure devotional service. But he's speaking about it from different reference points for several reasons. One is for the well-being of all living beings for all time to come, so that we could understand everything within creation, everything within spirituality, religion, or yoga in the context of bhakti, in relationship to bhakti, or pure love of Krishna. And he's also inquiring because any aspect that involves Krishna, the more you love Krishna, the more it's infinitely relishable. We find Sukadev Goswami in great detail in so many different places of Srimad Bhagavatam telling Parikshit Maharaj, who only has 7 days to live, about the intricate mechanical process of creation. Well, most of us, if we have 7 days to live, we want to hear Krishna's pastimes. And that's just what Sukadeva Goswami is telling, because Krishna's way of creating the universes, the cosmic manifestation, is a pastime. And he describes these things again and again to prepare us to actually have a realization of the 10th canto, Krishna's pastime. But for Uddhava, did he need to be prepared? Parikshit Maharaj, he was the son of Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Abhimanyu. He was constantly hearing about Krishna's loving leelas. So here we find Uddhava asking about the yoga prospects and mystic perfections. And Krishna's talking about how to achieve mystic powers, yogic powers. Anima, Mahima, Lagima. We're on that one today. And Krishna's not talking about these mystic powers as a way to lord it over material nature, to show the world how great we are, to solve people's material problems. He's speaking everything in reference to pure devotional service, meditation on the form of the Lord. He's putting everything in the context of bhakti. In the previous verse, he tells, when we absorb our mind in meditating on Krishna in his form as the Mahatattva, and meditates upon me as the supreme soul of the total material existence, that person achieves the mystic perfection called Mahima. So the mystic perfection is just a byproduct. The real essence of the process is to meditate on Krishna. Mahima means to be bigger than the biggest. So we meditate on Krishna as the biggest of the biggest. Anima, smaller than the smallest. We meditate on Krishna, who's the Super Soul, the Paramatma, in between every atom. And here, how to become lighter than the lightest. Lucky Ma. Would you like to learn how to do that? So we will begin today's class. Krishna says, I exist within everything, and I am therefore the essence of the atomic constituents of material elements. By attaching his mind to me in this form, the yogi may achieve the perfection called Lagima, by which he realizes the subtle atomic substance of time. Time in Sanskrit, Kala, is one of the great names of Krishna. Krishna's Kala. Because time is his energy, which is all pervading within the entire created existence. And because Krishna is not different than his energy, Parasya Shaktir Vivadaiva Shruyate, Kala is Krishna. Mayadhyakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam Hetunana Nikontaya Jagadviparivartate. Krishna tells this material nature is working under my direction. The whole cosmic manifestation is always under the supervision of Krishna. And the Bhagavad Gita tells these five principles, which is prominent of the teachings of the Gita. Ishvara, the supreme truth, the cause of all causes, the all-attractive Lord, who's the source of Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. The jiva, the eternal part and parcel of the Lord. Prakriti, material nature, or the energy of the Lord. It's described, there's two types of prakriti, jiva prakriti, which is the eternal soul, and the prakriti of material nature, which is eternal, but it's always changing. The manifestations of material energy are always changing. They're temporary. But material nature is eternal. And then there is time, kala, which is eternal, ever-existing. And karma, which is the science of understanding the laws and of action and reaction. This is an energy of the Lord, which is temporary. So in reference to eternal time, it's this energy of Krishna, which he manifests at the very beginning, at the very conception of material existence. Krishna manifests himself through his energy as the Mahatattva, which is like a massive, it's compared to a massive cloud within the Brahmajyoti or Parabhyoma or the spiritual sky. And nothing's happening in that Mahatattva. It's just an existence. But within that existence is limitless potential. And when Krishna glances in the form of Lord Narayan or Vishnu, Karana Dakshayi Vishnu, when he glances within upon that Mahatattva, two things happen. He impregnates all the jivas who are karmically meant to be there. That means every living entity in the entire cosmic manifestation, limitless universes. Incredible. In this world, whether we're animals or birds or lizards, human beings, and there's the process of impregnating life into another person. And a man has great potency if he can impregnate a woman with one child. What to speak of twins, or triplets, or what do they call them, quadruples? There's usually not much more than that. But some of the lower species, they have many more than that. Seems quite incredible. How is this possible? But Krishna, every living, there's more living entities in this room today than there is the whole human population of Earth. So many living entities living in everybody's body. In the air, so many. Krishna impregnates the Mahatattva with all the living entities within the whole cosmic manifestation. But even them, they're all completely unconscious. And Krishna also impregnates the Mahatattva with his own personal energy of kala, or time. And it's through time that the whole process of creation is activated. The three modes of material nature within this pradana, goodness, passion, ignorance, and all the different material elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, ego, they're all in an invisible, unmanifested, dormant state. But time activates everything. And through the power of time, mixing with the three modes of nature and the jiva and the jivas, all the planets, all the variegatedness within each planet, within each universe, and all living entities, they all begin to develop. And then they all, by the power of time, everything and everyone is interacting with each other. Actually, within the universal creation, by Krishna's arrangement, everything and everyone is either directly or indirectly interacting with everything and everyone else. But because of our false egos, we don't recognize it. We're just thinking in terms of I and mine and this physical, emotional state. But everything's connected. And Krishna, in the form of time, he activates the effect of time, according to these verses, by influencing the smallest of all particles of creation, which we call here the atoms. There's a similarity between the concept of an atom in modern science and the Vedic principle. In the Vedic principle, though, it describes the atom as the smallest, most basic, indivisible element of creation. And everything big and small that has a form or even the air is constituted by these atomic particles. So time is activating the atoms, and through those atoms that are interacting with each other, they're creating all the constant change of the universe. They cause things to be created. It's by the power of time, through the atoms, that we're sustained. And ultimately, everything is in the process of annihilation. Apparently. There is no such thing as death or annihilation. It's just how it appears to us. It's actually about change. Durga, who is the goddess of material energy, that's how she works. In time, she's controlling everything by the power of time, which is Krishna's. She's Krishna's energy. And we see in a very predominant way, Kali Mata. She's the Shakti. She's the Shakti of the Supreme Lord. And she's showing a very, what is, fast forward. Yes. Today, we see people who are good photographers. They'll just put a camera in front of a tree and leave it there for like 50 years. And you see, and then they put it on fast forward motion, and you see the tree growing right before your eyes. You see the sun rising and setting, and going through all of its different places of the sky within 5 minutes. Well, Kali's like that. She just speeds up the annihilation process. You know, because whoever we are, all these asuras who are exploitative, egoistic, demoniac people who are troubling the world, you know, the, on the atomic level, time is already killing them. But in the form of Kali, within a second it's done. So time, it's working on this very, very subtlest level. But because time is eternal, she never stops working. Nothing could stop her. No one could stop her. And in many ways, for a devotee, that's the beauty of material existence. For a person who doesn't take shelter of the Lord, it's very fearful. Krishna tells in Arjuna, time I am, devouring everything. And even Arjuna did not like to see this form of Virat Rupa, just annihilating everything. But that's what's happening at every moment in the form of time. The Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita, Mam cha yo vyabhicharina bhakti yogena sevate sagunam samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. That when we follow the principles of bhakti yoga, when we engage in the loving devotional service of the Lord, by the Lord's mercy we become free from the modes of material nature and all of its influences. So all of these descriptions are being given. Yes, we can scientifically, analytically understand how things are working, why they're working, but it's all for the purpose, really, of giving us this very strong conviction that the only real solution to the problems of this world is to take shelter of the Lord. We can't fight time. We could eat healthy foods and get proper exercise and all these things. And that helps us so that we have better strength and stamina and a little more longevity. But still, imperceptibly, time is there, influencing the atomic particles that we'll never be able to see to create changes. Actually, everything is changing abruptly at every moment on the atomic level. But because of our gross senses, we only perceive it after time. It's all happening right now. But it may take about 20 years till you look in the mirror and you see what happened. But we're just seeing the effect of what's constantly happening. So for an ordinary person, look in the mirror when you're 70 years old. Or for most of you, 30 years old, 40 years old. You start thinking you're getting old then. What's happening? And you look at a photo of yourself when you were young and you're thinking, why? But for one who understands the science of self-discovery, it's beautiful. It's Krishna's energy doing all these things. If this is what Krishna wants to do within material creation, there must be a good reason. And what is the ultimate reason? To give us the conviction that there's no other real solution except taking shelter. And when we take shelter, ashraya, then we realize our eternal blissful nature in relationship to the all-beautiful, all-loving, all-merciful, supreme, absolute truth, Sri Krishna. Krishna wants to give us that because that's who we are. Because Krishna loves us, he doesn't want us to just be stuck in some complacent state of material enjoyment. Because the nature of material enjoyment is we become attached to it. We don't want to give it up. So why would we take shelter of Krishna? Either we have a higher taste of Krishna's love, but when we've forgotten that, when we see that we can't hold on to anything, and when we understand from today's verses, it's not only that we're not going to be able to hold on to what we have in the future. It's already happening at this moment. It's already in the process of going away from us. Krishna's supreme opulence can be understood on every level. Importantly, on the atomic, on the level of the atomic particles. How forever the nature of Prakriti is its constantly being transformed by time. So yogis who want to get these powers, who want to get they can get one tiny little bit of power. Yes, there are some yogis who actually are 100 years old, 200 years old, 300 years old, 400 years old, 500 years old. It's true. You can do that. But they all die. You know, whether you die at 5 years old or 500 years old, when you see reality from the perspective of eternity, it doesn't make much difference. That's why Shukadev Goswami tells Parikshit Maharaj, better to have one moment of full consciousness of loving devotion to the Supreme Lord than a long, long, long life without that. Because by the power of time, death is inevitable. And however many mystic cities we get, and to whatever degree we get those cities, we're still under the influence of Kala, Kala Chakra. We're still under this system of how time is going to affect us. And everything is going to be taken away. Materially, except for the karmic reactions that come and go. But that's all taken away too. So in bhakti yoga, we don't really care about these mystic cities. If Krishna wants to give them, he can give. But usually he doesn't give. Because they're really create temptations that are quite irresistible if we have any conditioned tendencies. Because a devotee wants to feel himself the eternal servant of the Lord. We want to give up this idea of being the controller. And if we have such powers of control, and the world will celebrate us so greatly, that's a distraction. The Brijabasis, can anyone think of any incident of the stories of the Brijabasis where they displayed mystic cities? Anyone? Hare Krishna Prabhu, Gaur Gopal Prabhu. Can you think of any? Yes? Huh? Radha Gopinath Prabhu? They were always just turning to Krishna. You know, when Trinavarta came, because we're talking about Lagima being lighter than the lightest. Krishna's Yogeshwara. He's attracting us because he's the supreme possessor of all yogic powers forever. And whatever city we may get, it's just an insignificant, tiny little particle of a temporary reflection of Krishna's mystic powers. So instead of being proud of having that, we're proud of what Krishna has. Arimo. So we love to tell the story. Trinavarta. What kind of power he had? He was really a yogi in the sense of accomplishments on the material platform. He was a person who could actually change his form into a whirlwind. Huge whirlwind, swirling around. When he came to Vrindavan, nobody could see anything. All the dust of the ground was into the air. And the wind was blowing so hard, it was ferocious. Totally bewildering. So the Brijavasis, what did they do? They were helpless. They actually had all mystic cities, but they had no Krishna covered any acknowledgement or any awareness that they had them. Because that increased their devotion. Durvasa Muni was such a mystic yogi. And he attacked Ambarish. Ambarish didn't demonstrate any powers to counteract it. He just took shelter of Krishna. So here is Trinavarta, who probably practiced many, 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 many births of different mystical processes to get the powers that he had to change his form and so many other things. And he picked up Krishna. And Krishna's lighter than the lightest and heavier than the heaviest. And he's only 1 year old at the time. Srila Prabhupada would like to say Krishna didn't practice different types of yogic processes to get his powers. He forever has these powers. He's just a 1 year old little child, and he's in the arms of Yashoda Mai. And while in the arms of Yashoda Mai, he becomes very heavy. And Yashoda Mai doesn't know what's happening. It's described that Krishna becomes heavier than the universe. And Yashoda Mai, she's holding Krishna. If Krishna becomes heavier than the universe, because that's what it says, how is it that Yashoda's body wasn't crushed and smashed to pieces? Because Krishna actually became heavier than the universe in her arms and on her lap. But at the same time, Krishna gave her the power to sustain him, but with difficulty. She had to put him down. That's in one place of Srimad Bhagavatam. She had to put Krishna down. And Krishna did that just so that this lila could take place. Because Krishna didn't, if he stayed in the arms of Yashoda, then Trinavarta would have picked up her too. And he wanted to spare Yashoda Mai from that condition. So she put him down and she went to another place, and Trinavarta picked up Krishna. Such a yogi. And went higher and higher and higher in the sky. He could fly. He was flying so high. Much more than any airplane. Much more than even rocket ships. He was going towards Swarga Loka. Instantly. You may have seen films of rocket ships taking off, going up into the sky, and they may go, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of miles an hour. Well, within a matter of moments, he was way, way beyond outer space. And Krishna is lighter than a feather. He's effortlessly taking Krishna up, up, up. And then by Krishna's will, he became so heavy. Unimaginably heavy. Without even changing his size. Krishna can be just maybe 2 feet in size. Just 1 meter in size or less. In the form of little Gopal. And he can assume a weight that's heavier than all the planets in the universe combined. That's Krishna. That's yoga. When we speak about yoga, that's the kind of yoga we speak about. Krishna, Yogeshwara. And Trinavarta could not hold him any longer. He had no alternative but to... He did all this just to take Krishna with him, and now he wanted to get to remove Krishna from him. And he was, with all of his strength, he was trying to push Krishna away. And little baby Krishna, his arm was so soft and so tender, so beautiful. He just put, Krishna put his arm around Trinavarta's neck and squeezed. And this was too much. The soft little tiny baby is squeezing the neck of a gigantic asura, mystic, powered whirlwind. And Krishna choked him. And Trinavarta's eyes popped. And he struggled. He couldn't breathe. He suffocated. And the weight of Krishna was too much for him to continue. And he fell down to the ground, even faster than he went up. When he hit the ground, his body just dislocated in all kinds of pieces. Not as a whirlwind. Now he became, you know, the form that he had previously. And Krishna was crawling around like he didn't know what was happening. And the gopis, well, Mother Yashoda, it described when Trinavarta took Krishna away, she was so much just worried about Krishna because she couldn't find Krishna. And there was so much dust, she was just looking everywhere for Krishna, but she couldn't look because she couldn't see. And finally, when the dust cleared, when Trinavarta was so high in the sky, Krishna was nowhere to be found. And as a mother, sometimes she would fall unconscious like a cow that had lost her calf. That's the common example. And after this massive crash on the ground, that was even more frightening. Everyone in Vrindavan is in so much anxiety. Where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? He was taken away by this demon, and now this massive crashing sound. And they come running to the site. And Krishna's just crawling around, looking like, what's happening? And they call so many Brahmins to perform different pujas to protect Krishna from further dangers. So this is Yogeshwara. When Keshi came running into Vrindavan as a massive giant horse, or when Aristasura was running and there was earthquakes under his hooves, the Brijavasis didn't take forms as big as Aristasura to fight him. When Indra sent torrents of rain, even though the Brijavasis had such powers, they had no recognition of their powers. They just took shelter of Krishna, who was the supreme power. And this is the conclusion
daivihe shukunamahi mamamaya duratyaya mame bhame prapadyante mayame tatatantite.
The conclusion of all this description is that the greatest power of all powers is to take shelter of Krishna's power, which means to have no false ego. Krishna, I'm yours. This idea of trying to prove ourselves better than another is simply a symptom of how disconnected we are from Krishna. Because as we're connected to Krishna, we have no need to do that. We have no will to do that. Because no one can, people compete with Krishna, but no one's of competition with Krishna. Hiranyakashipu had such mystic powers. But Narasimhadev, when he was fighting, he was just playing with him. He's playing, letting Hiranyakashipu think that maybe he'll win. And then effortlessly, he defeated him. So when we hear these stories, we don't want to, the whole idea of the story of Narasimhadev is Mahajano Yena Gatasa Panta, to teach us we should follow in the footsteps of Prahlad. Prahlad's strength was he took shelter of Krishna. The Brijavasi's strength is they take shelter of Krishna. Ambarish Maharaja's strength is he took shelter of Krishna. And when we take shelter of Krishna, we recognize, we appreciate how Krishna in the form of time is so powerful. He's changing everything at every moment, both on the atomic level and on the universal level. The sun is shining by the power of Krishna and the power of time. The sun is shining and giving light and life to everyone within the universe. But within the sun planet, it's all constituted of those indivisible little atomic particles, which are all being moved around by Krishna in the form of time. That's Krishna. And Krishna is in the heart of every living being. He's the source of our knowledge. He's the source of our forgetfulness. He's the source of our remembrance. So we want to hear these teachings of Krishna. We want to hear these descriptions of how Krishna is performing his leelas within material creation, within his various incarnations, within Vrindavan. And the more we hear them in the association of devotees, the more we appreciate. That there's no greater aspiration that we could have in life than to remember Krishna, than to give our hearts to Krishna. Because when we become part of Krishna's inner family, and he's inviting all of us to do that, then all the powers of Krishna he shares with us. We can see them, we can feel them, we can praise them. And that is Mahaprabhu Sri Chaitanya's process of Sankirtan. So simple, but so sublime. To whoever, to forever be immersed in the remembrance of Krishna through praising his glories and praising his holy names. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam tells, with every rising and setting of the sun, the ordinary person is one day closer to death. But for one who hears and chants the glories of the Lord Sri Krishna, with every rising and setting of the sun, we are one day closer to eternal life. Her question? Is there anyone else who may have a question? Dwarkadish Prabhu?
Hare Krishna. Well, Ambarish Maharaj is a Kshatriya. Arjun is a Kshatriya. Both are warriors. And yet the way they take shelter is different. Ambarish Maharaj is surrendering to whatever Mahakrishna, Rakhya Krishna, that type of approach. Whatever the Lord wants, let it happen through Durvasa. And Arjuna is taking is supposed to take up weapons and fight. And not allow things to happen just the way the Kauravas want. So we devotees may sometimes get confused whether the approach is to actually fight for justice, or just allow things to happen the way they are happening because it's Krishna's will, it's the higher powers, it's destiny, etc. Or should we really do something to really counteract and like that? So the approach is different.
That can be answered from different perspectives. One is Ambarish was a king, so he had armies. And in his kingdom, when there was injustices caused to the innocent by those who were trying to exploit them, he punished them. He fought. Ambarish was a warrior too. He was a king. In those days, kings were not just politicians. They were warriors. Usually the king was the most powerful warrior in his army. Yes. Or one of them. So Ambarish, he was humble, he was fair, but he, like Yudhishthir Maharaj, like Parikshit Maharaj. You know, Parikshit Maharaj, when he was cursed by the Brahmin boy Sringi, he accepted the curse. But when Kali was hurting a cow, he drew his sword and was about to destroy him. Yes? In fact, Parikshit Maharaj traveled around the world protecting the innocent and fighting against injustices. But when there was a curse against him directly and personally, he took shelter of the Lord. And similarly, Ambarish Maharaj, because it was against him personally, he just took shelter of the Lord. In the case of Arjuna, it wasn't about him. It was about the Dharma of the whole world. It was about Yudhishthir Maharaj, his brother. And therefore, Krishna reminded him of his duty. And Srila Prabhupada would give example of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when Ramchandra Puri insulted him. He accepted it. Ramchandra Puri was blaspheming Lord Chaitanya. You eat too much. And you're a hypocrite. See these ants. Everyone come and look at these ants. These ants, he wasn't saying this just to Lord Chaitanya, he was telling everybody this. These ants are evidence that this Sri Chaitanya, such a hypocrite, he's secretly eating sweets. We were just in Puri, there's ants everywhere, whether you eat sweets or not. But he's declaring this blasphemy. And Lord Chaitanya, when devotees were very upset, he said, no, he's my well-wisher. He's right. From now on, I will reduce the amount I eat every day. So he didn't defend himself. But when Jagaya Madai offended Lord Nityananda, he called for his Sudarshan Chakra. When Gopal Chapala did not physically inflict any pain on Srivas Thakur. He was just doing the same thing Ramchandra Puri was doing. He was creating false propaganda against him and criticizing him. Because it happened to a devotee, the person got leprosy. Until he finally became humble and took shelter, then he was cured. So in the case of Ambarish and in the case of Arjuna, Arjuna was fighting for the justice of the whole world. That was his duty. And Ambarish did the same thing. He would fight for the justice of the whole world, as did Parikshit. When it was something personally against them, they just took shelter of the Lord. Does that answer your question?
Hello, Haribol. In our case, usually it's more personal, right, Maharaj? We are not kings here defending the world, etc. I mean, we are not really responsible for what's happening in the world. Usually injustices are done to ourselves on an individual basis. It's a singular thing.
We certainly have a right to clarify things when we were falsely accused. That's natural. It also protects our service to society. But we don't do it in a vengeful way. And ultimately, even if we're clarifying things nicely, we, in our hearts, we're taking shelter of Krishna. That's really at the heart of this subject. Because Arjuna, he fought, but he was completely taking shelter of Krishna in the reason for and in the way he was fighting. Yes? In the Bhagavad Gita, he surrendered to Krishna. And he only fought in his mood of taking shelter and surrendering to Krishna. And Ambarish took shelter of Krishna just standing in one place and praying. And Arjuna took shelter of Krishna by going through a whole battle. But they were both taking shelter of Krishna. And they were both in the mood of service to Krishna. So whatever may come of the dualities of this world, at the heart of it is, are we taking shelter of Krishna? You know, are we trying to do Krishna's will in this situation? That's common. That's the thread that is within the garland of so many different color flowers, which may be the situations and how we're supposed to react according to our duty. But the thread that connects it all is devotee is taking shelter of Krishna. And taking shelter of Krishna is to do Krishna's will in the situation. So now we will have a few minutes of kirtan, and then you have announcements. We'll do after kirtan.